Welcome to today's Bulwark Podcast. Today's episode is brought to you by our friends at Quip. And of course, happy Thanksgiving to everyone. We're going to continue to call it Thanksgiving despite the apparently vast campaign out there to change the name of Thanksgiving. I don't know whether people heard the president's comments last night in Florida, where he made it very, very clear that he's going to be a bulwark against the war on Thanksgiving. This is what he had to say.
As we gather together for Thanksgiving, you know, some people want to change the name Thanksgiving. They don't want to use the term Thanksgiving. And that was true also with Christmas, but now everybody's using Christmas again. Remember I said that? But now we're going to have to do a little work on Thanksgiving. People have different ideas why it shouldn't be called Thanksgiving. But everybody in this room I know loves the name Thanksgiving, and we're not changing it.
Okay, I be quite honest. I don't think that I've ever heard anyone, and I read pretty widely in social media, suggest that we should not call Thanksgiving Thanksgiving. So our guest today is CNBC's John Harwood, who keeps his finger on the pulse of the nation. You hang out with all the coastal elite lefties, right? Is this a thing?
It is not a thing. But the culture war for President Trump is a thing because it's the principal means he has right now of trying to bind his base together and protect his interests with voters and also Republican elected officials who are dependent on his good graces to retain their hold on that base. So this is the president extending the alleged and also phony war on Christmas to new frontiers.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you know, part of me would want to just laugh this off, and I think it was a la pundit on Twitter suggesting that, is this like Fox News executives were sitting around betting with one another that, okay, we can make this thing trend, that we can actually, if we say it enough, that there's a war on Thanksgiving, that we can get our loyal listeners believing that, you know, by God, they came after Christmas first, but Donald Trump saved Christmas, but now it's Thanksgiving. Can they actually make it a thing? But you're actually right. It is this, you have to keep finding some new point of grievance, some way in which we are under siege and only Donald Trump stands between us and the people who almost destroyed Christmas. But anyway, happy Thanksgiving, John Harwood.
Same to you, Charlie.
Hey, speaking of which, I wanted to, when I was just sitting down here, knowing that we were going to talk on the podcast today, I looked up one of your famous moments. You know, we all have famous moments, and it's all downhill from here. That's not true. but this was a classic moment, I thought, or certainly a very memorable moment, from October of 2016, when you were one of the moderators of the presidential debate, and you asked what turned out to be a controversial question of then candidate Donald Trump. And this is what you asked him.
Is this a comic book version of a presidential campaign?
It's not a comic book. And it's not a very nicely asked question the way you say that.
I talked to economic advisors who have served presidents of both parties. They said that you have as much chance of cutting taxes that much without increasing the deficit as you would of flying away from that podium by flapping your arms really.
Then you have to get rid of Larry Kudlow, who sits on your panel, who's a great guy, who came out the other day and said, I love Trump's tax plan.
Well, John, that aged pretty well, didn't it?
I think it did. It made Republicans very angry at the time, and it contributed to the way that Ted Cruz sort of ignited the candidates on stage and the studio audience for that debate against us, and it made it kind of a disorderly affair. The backdrop for that, of course, was that in the weeks leading up to the debate, Republicans who were working for other campaigns were complaining to me that we in the mainstream media were giving a ton of attention to Donald Trump, building him up. They thought it was ridiculous. A representative of another campaign said, how do you guys sleep at night putting Trump on television like that? He's a joke. Well, as I reflected on the things that Trump was saying and the lack of seriousness of the things that he was saying, I knew that they were right. And so I framed a question that was designed to illustrate how nutty the things that he was saying actually were. As it happened, they weren't too nutty for Republican primary voters, and those other campaigns never were able to knock him off. Many of them ended, Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio, among others, ended the campaign saying much worse things about Donald Trump than I ever said, but it didn't shake his ability to win the nomination. And now all those people have knuckled under him as his presidency proceeds. And I'm proud of that moment.
No, I obviously need to correct something that I said was wrong. I said October 2016. This was obviously October of 2015 because our long national nightmare is longer than we actually think it is. But I think what's interesting about the question going back to it is you raised the issue of, you know, building the wall, making another country pay for it, which is we now know, of course, we knew then, and we know definitively now Mexico is not going to pay for the wall. 11 million people were not deported. The deficit is in fact exploded and all of these other things. It reminds me that so much of what's happened in Trump's presidency is not shocking because he is who we thought he was. And the comic book campaign has become this sort of dark, bizarro comic book presidency.
Yeah, that the only thing I regret about that question was that what's happened is turned out to be darker than I would have expected. And like many people, I thought that Trump would be changed by the presidency, that he would have people around him who were more serious about governing than he was. And that was a little bit true, at least in terms of some serious people at the beginning of his presidency, but it's no longer true. He has no constraints on him, and he has not been changed by the office at all to the detriment of the rest of us. So it's a very difficult situation that we find ourselves in, and because many Republicans are so dependent on him for the well-being of their careers or their post-politics careers, they are unwilling to stand up to what he's saying, even when they know it's not true. And we're seeing that, of course, on the Ukraine story, where people are repeating this story about, or the speculation about, Ukraine interfering in the election, which, as Fiona Hill testified in the impeachment hearings, is actually fabricated Russian propaganda that they're spreading. Secretary of State, U.S. senators, it's remarkable.
It is remarkable, and this is the biggest shock to me, because Donald Trump actually turned out to be exactly who I thought he was going to be. I never really thought he was going to pivot, but it is remarkable, though, to watch the way the Republican Party has in fact accommodated him. He did not change, so they changed. And you go back to that moment you asked that question in October of 2015, and the Republican Party was overwhelmingly skeptical of Donald Trump. They knew who he was. They got him. They weren't necessarily prepared to confront him. But you think about the number of elected officials around the country that were in favor of Donald Trump back then, and then watch the transformation right now. And now you just put your finger on something that is, I think it's probably one of the most difficult things of dealing with right now, is the fact that the president of the United States is the conspiracy theorist in chief, and that he is pushing a conspiracy theory that is not to simply debunk. Debunk doesn't seem strong enough word, does it, for the idea that the, you know, CrowdStrike has the server in Ukraine or something like this. I mean, this is pure fantasy. And the fact that it's validated, even remotely validated, by other grown-ups in government really makes this sort of a mind-bending moment to be alive.
I agree completely, and in fact, I think it's an exaggeration even to call it a theory. It's not a theory right. That has any plausibility that anyone believes. It is something that's made up to absolve Russia from their interference in the campaign to help elect President Trump, and because blaming Ukraine absolves Russia, it also absolves Trump, who, as Robert Mueller told us, knew about and welcomed Russian interference in the campaign. I want to go back to one thing you said about 2015 and those other Republican candidates. When we were in the October of 2015. All those candidates were not attacking Trump, and the reason they attacked us after that debate was because they assumed he would collapse and wanted to inherit his supporters. And it turned out that they underestimated the hold that Donald Trump, or the resonance that Donald Trump had with those voters. And that's what's put us where we are. And you have this odd situation where, you know, at the rally that Trump had, where he was raising the fantasy war against Thanksgiving, he delivered a characteristic riff where he said, "You know, America is respected again." That is not something that's empirically true at all. If you look at surveys of voters overseas or residents overseas, or the behavior of our allies, but it is true that Donald Trump validates a certain constituency within the Republican Party. He shows them, or at least purports to show them, respect, and I think that's what he's talking about. Many of those people, lesser educated white voters, more blue collar white voters who feel looked down upon by coastal elites and people who make more money or went to fancy colleges. He is playing on that sentiment very, very effectively.
No, he is. There's no question about it. And despite the fact that we are not more respected around the world, that we are sort of in retreat around the world, doesn't seem to register. It is interesting, though, how he will play these certain notes. He's apparently very, very enthusiastic about the fact that he has pardoned three accused war criminals. And in fact, he's so enthusiastic about it that he bragged about it last night, saying that, you know, he stood up for them against the deep state, which I guess means the entire chain of command of the U.S. military, and reportedly wants to campaign with these pardoned accused war criminals, which is very interesting because it's a fundamental act of disrespect for good order and discipline in the military. It's an act of disrespect to the chain of command of the U.S. military. But I think at some, you know, his at some instinctual level, he knows that that plays with his base.
You know, this is where I wonder for more traditional Republicans who have grown up venerating military service, venerating veterans. Is there a point that is too far to say that he's standing up against the deep state is so grotesque? Because in the case of Eddie Gallagher, his fellow Navy SEALs testified against him. That wasn't
exactly
a deep state. That was exactly the people who we hold up as the best of America. And that is such a breach of the kind of things that our military leaders have led us to expect and desire and appreciate. You do have to wonder if some of those Republicans say, no, that's a bridge too far, but we haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, no, we haven't seen it yet. But, you know, his one quote where he's talking, he refers to these soldiers as war fighters, saying, you know, we make them killing machines and then we punish them when they kill people, which, of course, anyone who is associated with the military knows that we don't train people to be killing machines. And this is part of the honor and the order of the military. And by intervening in these cases, he essentially said, in Gallagher's case, that he did not trust the judgment of the Navy SEALs in order to determine, you know, what the standards of their service were. But it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. So let's talk about the last 24 hours, because it's really been, we have had this cascade of information that's come out about through the impeachment process. And as usual, over the last 3 years, it's hard to keep up. But over the last 24 hours, we got some interesting timelines, didn't we? Including the answer to that fundamental question, what did the president know and what did he know? And how significant is it that the fact that we now know, according to the New York Times, that Donald Trump knew about the whistleblower complaint when he decided to finally release that military aid to Ukraine?
I think that's a fact that we have all assumed was true. And it's the only logical inference you can draw from the sequence of events that happened. But now we have it documented. And in fact, we know that earlier, before September, when the aid was released, as far back as June, the president was hearing about or White House lawyers were hearing about disquiet among people within the federal government about the holdup, the questions that were being raised. The president, it's obvious that the president directed Rudy Giuliani to do these things, to undertake these errands. He did it with the acquiescence of Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State. Those things are beyond dispute. But now, as we have emails that are surfacing and FOIA requests and lawsuits by people who are looking into this, as well as what the impeachment inquiry itself is finding, we're seeing this documented, and it's crystal clear. And the only question now is what the Congress is willing to do about it.
Was there an indication that we got yesterday that Trump might be throwing Rudy Giuliani under the bus a bit? He was asked, I think it was by Bill O'Reilly of all people, was asked whether or not he ordered Giuliani to do the various things he did with Ukraine, and he sort of kind of distanced himself, said, "No, I didn't. I didn't really know what he was doing, but Rudy is a warrior." So is there an attempt to say, "I didn't really know what Rudy was doing"?
I think he was shoving Rudy Giuliani toward that bus with both hands as hard as he possibly could. The idea that Rudy Giuliani did this on his own, when we know that this president, as he said famously a few weeks ago, people talk about the team. There's no team. I'm the team. He directed Giuliani to do this. He told President Zelensky in the phone call that you should talk to Rudy Giuliani and Bill Barr. But we also know that the president has no loyalty to any abstract idea or any person other than himself. And in this case, he recognizes that the case against him is very strong. That doesn't mean that he'll be convicted in the Senate, but the actual case against what he did, his conduct, is very strong, and he will instinctively look for ways to insulate himself from that. And the question for anyone else is, are they willing to believe it? And I think most people with common sense will not believe it, but if you're the president and you're trying to kick up dust and obscure the situation, maybe you'll get some people, at minimum, confused.
What role do you think, if any, will Don McGahn and John Bolton play in all of this process? We had a rather dramatic federal court decision that is going to be appealed, saying that Don McGahn does not have absolute immunity to testify. John Bolton's attorney is saying that, well, he's not quite ready yet. He's tweeting, but he's not willing to testify. Now, both Don McGahn and John Bolton know a lot of stuff, but will they be part of this impeachment process at all?
I'm doubting it. You know, we'll see, and the House, while moving ahead with impeachment articles, may make efforts to get them to come in. But remember that these two men, unlike Fiona Hill, Bill Taylor, some of the other people involved and offering testimony that was very piercing, cutting through the fog during those impeachment hearings, they live in this ecosystem of Republican ideologues, Republican political operatives, Republican audiences for future legal work, for future books, for future employment. It is very difficult for them, people like them, to go against the tribe. And in this case, they plainly have information of great value to Democrats and impeachment investigators. But whether they're willing to, in a fulsome way, provide what they know and state it plainly, we don't have any reason to have a lot of confidence in that.
No, I think you're exactly right. And I think that's especially true of John Bolton, who is creating a super PAC and clearly wants to remain relevant within conservative circles. And Breaking Bad against the president in this particular way would really end,
exactly.
end that viability. I mean, he would be excommunicated. And so, you know, that would be it for the super PAC. It would be it for the you know, conservative think tank world. So
Breaking Bad is a good way to describe it.
Yeah, very much so. Speaking of drug deals. So there's rather startling development in the Democratic race for president that I want to talk with you about in a moment. But let's hear a word from our sponsor. Today's episode is brought to you by Quip, makers of the Quip electric toothbrush. This is something I actually have. I've been using it for months now, and they want you to know that the one single discovery that matters most for your dental care is simply this. If you have good habits, you're good. That means brushing for 2 minutes twice a day and flossing regularly, no matter what brand you use. But Quip makes that simple, starting with an electric toothbrush, refillable floss, and anti-cavity toothpaste. Quip's electric brush has sensitive sonic vibrations with a built-in timer and 30-second pulses to guide a full and even clean. And the Quip floss dispenser comes with pre-marked string to help you use just enough. Plus, Quip delivers fresh brush heads, floss, and toothpaste refills to your door every 3 months with free shipping, so your routine is always right. You never run out. You don't have to run to the store. It comes right to you. Join more than 3 million healthy mouths and get Quip today, starting at $25. And if you go to getquip.com/sykes, that's S-Y-K-E-S, right now, you'll get your first refill free. That's your first refill free at getquip.com/sykes, S-Y-K-E-S. Let me spell that out. GETQUIP.com/sykes. Quip, the good habits company. Okay, we are back with John Harwood from CNBC. Now, your title there is editor-at-large, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm an editor-at-large as well, too. That's a great title, isn't it?
Isn't it? It sort of gives you command over the entire landscape.
Yeah, but with not really responsibility for anything. It's kind of perfect.
It's sort of, exactly. Yeah,
it's a little bit like consultant.
There you go.
But from one editor at large to a
senior advisor. Yeah.
Exec senior advisor or you see on cable television, strategist. Whatever that means,
I don't know
what that means. Okay, so Quinnipiac poll out showing that Joe Biden is back in first place, but I think the other dramatic takeaways would be the decline of Elizabeth Warren, who seems to have plateaued and stalled, and the rise of Pete Buttigieg, who is now in second place. So, if this poll is accurate and it's a national poll, as opposed to a state-by-state poll, you have two of the quote-unquote centrists leading the pack, and the more revolutionary candidates appear to be, you know, have dropped down to 3 and 4. So is there a centrist surge in the Democratic Party right now?
I think there may be. And in addition to that, another reflection of that impetus is the entry into the race of Mike Bloomberg, the former New York City mayor, and Deval Patrick, the former Massachusetts governor. I think we've seen this in the last couple of debates, a heightened sense of energy from people like Buttigieg, Biden, Amy Klobuchar, Cory Booker to some degree, because he has also distanced himself from the further left positions of Warren and Sanders. And it looks as if, in hindsight, that the decision of Elizabeth Warren to fully embrace a full-scale Medicare for All program that eliminates private insurance and then take the risk of outlining exactly how she's going to pay the enormous cost of that might have been a crystallizing moment for people who worry, hey, wait, can we really defeat Donald Trump with this kind of positioning? Now, that's not to say she's been proven wrong, but certainly in the ebb and flow of the campaign, and I think it remains fluid, you have an action-reaction situation, and that action on her part, which caused people to focus on the sums involved and the levels of taxation involved and the extent of government intrusiveness or assumption of responsibility in healthcare, all of that galvanized people, and I think there is a bit of a centrist resurgence. On the other hand, we've still got a couple of months to go until the Iowa caucuses, and we don't know what the next turn in the trajectory is going to be.
No, I think that that's right. It did feel like that was a real inflection moment, that you know, she was surging, she was rising in the polls, she came out with that plan. People looked at it and went, whoa, okay, are we going to go into the 2020 campaign with this plan to take away people's private health insurance. Other Democrats began rather robust, muscular attacks on all of that, including Pete Buttigieg and Biden, who went after that and said, you know, yes, Medicare for all who want it as an alternative. And at that moment, it just felt like the air went out of her momentum. And I don't know
and
how.
Don't forget the role that Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker, has played in this. Nancy Pelosi came out and said, I'm not a fan of Medicare for all. She, of course, as the one of the principal movers behind the passage of Obamacare, wants to protect that legacy. And she, above all people, recognizes how difficult it is to get the votes for major changes in the American healthcare system. And that was a splash of cold water on the face of all the people who think, oh yeah, we'll win the presidency in 2020 and enact Medicare for all. Not to say that it's impossible, but it's really, really hard.
Well, there were two others, now that you mentioned that. You also had President Obama's comments where he talked about, Americans don't want this, want revolutionary policies. And of course, you had that New York Times Siena poll that came out around the same time, maybe it'd been the same week, that was really, speaking of splash of cold water, pointing out that Trump was very competitive in all of those swing states that are going to determine who gets to 270 electoral votes, and that Warren was either even or running behind him in all of those states. So that was a moment where I think Democrats stepped back rather significantly. But I am seeing this strong streak of pragmatism here. The focus on that this election is about defeating Donald Trump, and an unwillingness to risk that by being, you know, excessively ideologically ambitious. But let's talk about Mayor Pete. Mayor Pete's surge, which means he's going to get his moment in the barrel. He's being hammered on, you know, from a variety of sides, including this viral piece from The Root, which I'm sure that you saw or heard about. You know, Mayor Pete is a lying MF-er because of his comments on race. And of course, people point out that he's not doing well with African-American voters. So he's going to be really tested over the next few weeks, I think, because you can tell that other candidates have been growing increasingly frustrated and irritated by his success as this 37-year-old small town mayor from Indiana who's suddenly now one of the front runners for president. So he's going to be taking some incoming, isn't he?
Charlie, it's so interesting. It's not just irritation. Many of these other campaigns seem to be outraged by Pete Buttigieg, partly for the reason you suggested. He's so young. He's as young as many of the leading operatives on the other campaigns, and they're looking at this guy who all of a sudden is a serious contender for the White House. But this is a guy with enormous, enormous political talent. He has got to figure out whether he can broaden his constituency. Obviously, he has struggled to attract African-American support. Much of that African-American support, which is very solidly behind Joe Biden, it's a very pragmatic constituency, more so than many of the white liberals in the Democratic Party, who I think are a little bit more entranced by the more ambitious proposals that we get from other campaigns. They've got their feet on the ground, and I do not think it is a fixed condition of the campaign that Pete Buttigieg can't get those votes. His strategy, of course, like that of other moderates in the race, depends on the assumption that Joe Biden is going to fall apart, that Joe Biden, who has run twice before for the presidency unsuccessfully, who has some obvious vulnerabilities at 77 years old. He also has some significant strengths. And if he does fade, that vote's going to go somewhere. Could it go to Pete? Yes. But of course, these other campaigns are working very hard to make sure that if that happens, it doesn't go to him.
Yeah, I think in the last 2 days, you've really seen his challenges, but also his strengths. I thought the attack on him in The Root was grossly unfair, you know, saying that he was, you know, this lying MF-er. There was no lie. It was just a different perspective. he essentially, well, he was quoted as saying 8 years ago, he suggested that one of the problems of inner city education was the lack of strong role models, which is a perspective. And the writer in The Root, Michael Harrington, had a different perspective from his life experience. But instead of talking about his life experiences, he attacked Buttigieg as a bald-faced liar, which I thought was way over the top. And unfortunately, you saw the kind of the quality of debate that sometimes you have on the left. But then yesterday, Buttigieg calls this writer up, the guy that called him an MFer, and he calls him up and they have a long conversation where I'm not sure that they resolved anything, but it was a rather extraordinary moment that told me that Mayor Pete is a world-class politician. Because I'm telling you, somebody writes that I'm an MFer, I don't call them up on the phone the next day. He does, talks to the guy. Harriet, who had just written this, you know, vicious attack on him, basically says, yeah, I kind of admire the guy's, you know, courage. And now I understand his perspective a little bit more. I'm not necessarily endorsing him, but at least he's, you know, all I know about him is he's a white guy, but he's a white guy who's willing to listen, which is about all I could expect. So it was like, okay, bad moment for Buttigieg yesterday that he turned into a, wow, this guy's got some interesting political instincts.
And that's what I mean by his talent. He had the instinct to do that. And the writer of the piece clearly was touched by it. And when he wrote a description of this conversation, he could see that Pete Buttigieg was a person of good faith. And yes, he may have a different perspective and he may use the word lying to describe it, which is not really apt, as you said. It's a different perspective. But he knows that this is a guy who was willing to engage with him, who reached out. And a lot of people who have been critical of Pete Buttigieg or reluctant to embrace him are going to hear that that's how he reacted to that, and that's to Buttigieg's credit.
And he managed to do it in a way that didn't look like he was on an apology tour or groveling. So I did think that this was one of those moments where he is skilled above his age level, but again, I don't know what's going to happen with him, but at 37, given Joe Biden's age, Pete Buttigieg can be a national political figure for the next four decades. So
there's no doubt about it.
Is worth reminding. John Harwood, thank you so much for taking time to join us on the podcast today.
Charlie, it was a pleasure.
And have a happy Thanksgiving, you and your family, because we're not going to change the name and we're not going to do away with Thanksgiving, just so you know, not on our watch.
Outstanding.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. We're going to be off tomorrow, and hopefully that you enjoy Thanksgiving. Today's episode was brought to you by our friends at Quip. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back on Friday and we'll do this all over again.